Amen. All right. Again, I think we have more than we have time for, but we're going to do the best we can. All right. A.W. Tozer, if you get the email, you saw this on one day this week. It was on your devotion. This is what A.W. Tozer, a great preacher and theologian, now dead, said. He said, "I often wish that there were some way to bring modern Christians into a deeper spiritual life painlessly by short, easy lessons." But such wishes are vain. No shortcuts exist. May not the inadequacy of much of our spiritual experience be traced back to our habit of skipping through the corridors of the kingdom like little children through the marketplace, chattering about everything but pausing to learn the true value of nothing? Wow. I'm afraid that he spoke this quite a few years ago, but how true it still is, and unfortunately will be. He said, "God has not bowed to our nervous haste or embraced the methods of our machine age. It is well that we accept the hard truth now. The man or the person who would know God must give time to him." Must give time to it. Might we still sit long enough to take in what God has for us? This is the greatest investment that we will ever make. If you remember last week, it was a little more technical for the reason that everything that Jesus says this week is based on the fact that he wanted to make sure everyone understood that he was the beginning and the end, and everything about the law was him. So now when he comes back and he addresses those things in the law that had been misunderstood and been even preached with a misunderstanding, he clarifies it, and now they understand when he says, "But I tell you," they understand for the fact that he is the he's the one who has the final say on it. You know, it's kind of amazing. Remember that movie a few years ago? You've Got Mail, back when email was really, I guess, really just becoming a big deal, where this bookstore owner was kind of taking over everything with the big store mentality and putting little bookstores out of business. And on one occasion, his name was Fox in the movie, Joe Fox. He met with one of the little bookstore owners that was going out of business, and this was his line to her. Said, "You know, it's just business. It's nothing personal." She said, "It's personal to me. It's personal to the people that work for me that are now losing their jobs." And that's exactly what Jesus does. He said, it's not just a religious thing. He says, it's very, very personal. So he moves all this external stuff that these people, religious people, they only were concerned about that and were not concerned about the personal level of it. He moves it from over there to right where we live. And that's exactly what we're going to look at quickly today. And we're going to have to jump through quite a bit of it quicker than, because we have more than we can carry in this short time than we have. Jesus gets personal. You know, what is it people a lot of times just say, whenever we get together as a group, especially if it's not a church group, we don't talk about God, and we don't talk about religion, and we don't talk about politics. Isn't that amazing? Then what else do you have to talk about? Politics affects every day of our life, right? Yes. Every aspect of our life is affected by somebody's politics. And eternity affects everything else. So if you can't talk about those two things, what do you have that's worth talking about? Really nothing. Oh, that's too personal. Then what do you want to talk about? Something that doesn't matter whatsoever? That's exactly the way people are. Oh, we don't talk about those two things, then we don't have anything to talk about. Why? Because nothing else really, if you take those two out of the picture, all the rest of it's fluff. Isn't that right? Personal. Jesus gets real, real personal in this one. When the people have heard, as we saw last week, Jesus says, "You have heard." It doesn't mean that what they heard was exactly what the law was. It could have been in some instances, but it could have been the interpretation of the law by some of the religious leaders that Jesus has to deal with, and we still have to deal with that. You know, you be careful whenever you read any kind of book from anybody, it's always an interpretation. You know, when you read a translation of the Bible in English, you got to remember, someone has interpreted that. They had to move it from Hebrew to English. They had to move it from Greek to Hebrew. They had to move it from, Greek to English. They had to move it from Aramaic to English. So you have to understand that. There's always that element. That is why some of them early on, they made us say, you know, you can't graduate unless you have a Greek and Hebrew. At least you can go back to that when the moment is critical and you need to go back to that, you'll be able to do that. So they force us on it. They don't do that anymore. Most seminaries don't even require that you have any Greek or Hebrew whatsoever. It's a thing of the past. So what happens? You're always dependent on somebody else's idea. And that's exactly why it's going on here when he does it. He says, but I tell you, so when Jesus is negating something, he's negating the opinion of what was passed on in the Old Testament. So he's going to correct it. He gets real personal when he does it too. But I say unto you, that reveals his authority. That's why last week we spent all that time when he says, I fulfill the law. I am it. So when I come back and I correct these things, you can depend on what I'm going to tell you because it's right. And he starts off with this one. Be careful with anger. You have heard that was said of them of old, you shall not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in the name of the judgment. But I say to you that whosoever is angry with his brother, and this without a cause, is not in all of the old manuscripts. There's speculation on whether it was truly that or could have been added because, you know, we want to soften it a little bit. You know, it could be without a cause. It could be a righteous cause, as Jesus will elaborate on for us just a little bit. But who shall say to his brother, Raca shall be in danger of counsel, but who shall say, you fool, shall be in danger of the hellfire. The word literally means murder or assassinate. When he says, thou shalt not kill, he's meaning actually committing murder or assassinating someone. It wouldn't be in the sense of self-defense. It wouldn't be in the sense of anything else, but like a premeditated murder or an assassination. But how is it that we handle anger? You know, and that's exactly what he says. The person who murders will be subject to judgment. Yep, a legal proceeding without question. He said, but I tell you, whoever is angry with his brother. Wow. Is he talking about just that we can he's only talking about our fellow believers? I don't think that. I think that's absolutely what he's talking about to some degree, but he's talking about in general. Some try to say, well, he's just talking about I can't be angry with my brothers and sisters in Christ. I don't think so. But it was a serious thing because he said they will go before the Sanhedrin and they'll be in danger of hell fire. You know, just a few years ago, I was kind of astonished in finishing my project. One of the books I had to read was about how basically, generally, in theological circles, we've done away with hell. It doesn't exist anymore. You know, by and large, in theological circles, in America especially, theologians across the board have said, you know, God doesn't have a hell that punishes people. That's not the kind of loving God we have. So they've actually tried to do away with it. This word here, when he says hellfire, you know, he's talking about, if you've ever been to Jerusalem, right outside on the south side is the Valley of Hinnom. In the Valley of Hinnom was where in the Old Testament they killed a lot of children and sacrificed them. But even in Jesus' day, it was a garbage pit. That's where they threw it all. And later on, he says what? He says the fire's always burning there and the worm never dies. There's always life and there's always punishment. He said that's exactly what it is. He said there's a serious punishment for people who hate people with anger even though they never kill them. You know, that's the astonishing part. So someone who, you know, this breaks it down a bit. So, well, you know, you call him a blockhead or you call him a fool or you call him something else. He said you have to be careful because that's a first step that leads to something worse. And that's the whole issue that he's getting to in the whole thing. Why? Behind the murder prescribed in verse 21 is always a personal anger. We're always offended. We always take it so personal that it leads to anger to the point that it can lead to murder. That's what he's getting behind. It's not just the fact that you don't literally kill them. It's the fact that you get so caught up in who you think you are and what you should get, and you're offended, that it leads to that. That is the issue. I read where 18th century, a physician by the name of John Hunter was a cutting-edge guy on surgeries. And actually, he was the one who was a surgeon for King George III. But he had a serious problem with anger, and he had angina. And what he did learn himself as a doctor was when he would always get so angry with people, that is what brought on his physical problem. But he hadn't controlled it. So actually, after a meeting one day with the London surgeon group there in a heated discussion, he walked outside the room and fell dead of his problem. His anger killed him. Isn't that amazing? It's amazing what anger does to people. And that's exactly what he says. We have to be careful in its, on a personal level. It starts down here, but this is where it leads to. And he said, we're just as guilty, even if we never kill them, because we have to deal with the first step of it back here on a personal front. And it leads all the way to the punishment of hell. In the Valley of Hinnom became a symbol of a place for punishment of hellfire. That's exactly what it was. But the main problem was animosity, hatred, that leads to the murder. He said, we have to go back and deal with it there. That's the problem most of the time. We don't want to go back and deal with it there, do we? You said, but Jesus got angry. Oh, he did. But how is his anger different than our anger? Here's a couple examples of it. Jesus said to his opponents, but when he saw the many of the Pharisees and Sadducees come to his baptism, he said, you generation of vipers, that didn't go over very well. He called the preachers, you bunch of snakes. Huh? You said, is that not nice? No, that's not nice. Who have warned you to flee from the wrath to come? In Luke, then he said to them, oh, fools, and slow of heart to believe, and all that the prophets have spoken. Is he contradicting his own teaching? Because Jesus was angry. Yes, he was. Absolutely. And Jesus went into the temple of God and cast him out. And what did he? Turned over the tables. It was without question. He was irate. It was not something good is going to happen to you today. So how do you reconcile this? He was angry, so why can't I be angry? Look at it. There's a place for burning anger at sin and injustice. Absolutely. And every time Jesus was angry, it was because they were taking advantage of the people. There was a sin being committed by the leaders, and there was an injustice going on. And that's what he was angry at. He didn't actually take a personal affront to it himself, because we'll see exactly how he responds whenever he was treated that way. It's that sort of offense that arouses the animosity and hatred in us when we're offended, when we're taken advantage of personally, that is the problem. How did he deal with it? When Jesus was involved, did he return it? No, what did he do? Whenever they did all those things to him personally, what did he say? Father, forgive them. But when the injustice was done to everything else, not his own personal level, he took it. He did it. And that's where the issue is in this whole thing. We can't go through every one of these verses today, so I skipped around and I tried to put the ones that kind of go together, and we'll come back to the other ones after graduation day, because a couple of them kind of go together. All his anger was vented at the injustice. That's where it was. He was quick to be angry. Why did he get so mad with, if you know the layout of the temple, and you've heard us talk about it before, where the Gentiles, they only had one little spot. When you first enter in, there was one tile called the Court of the Gentiles. That's the only place they could go. So the Pharisees and the religious leaders had kind of pushed them out of the picture, and they set up shop right out there where the only place the Gentiles was. And Jesus, boy, it made him mad. He said, no, that's not the way it was. So he was angered over the fact that religious people were treating the base people injustice, and they couldn't do anything about it. That's why he was so mad. It wasn't something that they did to him personally. And when they did it to him personally, he took it. The text is dealing with anger in the personal area, and relationship is clear from the two examples that Jesus gives. Look at these two that he gives. First, therefore, if you're offering your gift, if you come to church and, you know, you're going to be holy and you're going to be right with God, and while you're there, if you remember that you've done something to offend someone else out there, he said, you need to stop. Go try to take care of that, because nothing you could bring to God, you can't worship God if you don't do something about that. If you've got something personally going on between you and someone else and you caused it, he said, you need to go fix it. Therefore, you're offering your gift at the altar. Therefore, remember that your brother has something against you, something you've done. Leave it and go and take care of it. But go and be reconciled and then come back. But then what if it goes on? What if you didn't do it, but someone else has done it to you? Same thing. Can't leave it. If you offended him, you go back. It's more important that we be reconciled to our brothers and sisters then we go through our religious experience. That's what Jesus said. Look at Matthew 18. Jesus also says the same sort of thing to the person who is offended. It goes both ways. Either way, you're supposing not the person who has caused the offense, but the person who has been offended. If you're the offender or the offendee, it doesn't really matter. He says, you really can't worship me. That, you know, that we have the gall to come up here and be hating somebody or have somebody hating us because of something we've done and come in here and think that everything's going to be all right with God. You say, well, that gets a little more personal. That's exactly what Jesus is talking about. It's not just some religious thing we can go through and everything's all right. I can't just come in here and hate somebody or have somebody hating me for something I've done and think everything's going to be all right with God. It's personal. And that's exactly what they didn't get it. They said, oh, as long as we don't kill anybody, we can hate them. He's going to come to that one quickly if I hurry up, all right? He says, son of Mary, you are to seek out the brother as you offended and try to get things sorted out. You said, but that's hard. Yeah, it is. You know, I can honestly say I don't like confrontation. I've had quite a bit of it. Because when you tell people the truth, you're just going to always have that. It's just going to be there. And if they accept the truth and you work through it, then you can do something about it. But every time this happened, I've backed off and said, God, where am I wrong in this situation? You know, I want to try to do the right thing. Sometimes those things have been fixed. Sometimes they haven't. But I honestly try to go to a person. I remember one time, I have to hurry for this story, when I was pastoring a church in North Carolina, and they had some plans set up before I ever got there for a building and doing this stuff. But what they're about to do was just not bright. You know, it wasn't. And I just posed, why don't we rethink this? Well, the guy in charge, he took it personal, and so he quit, and he got mad. And, you know, I'd go over to his house constantly, and I said, you know, I think we had a misunderstanding. He wouldn't even talk to me. I said, well, and I'd keep going back. I said, I think we just need to talk about it, try to figure this thing out. And he still wouldn't. His wife still came. His grown children still came. I was trying to do everything I could. But that was kind of his personality. Either his way or no way. His way happened to be wrong. And when he resigned, somebody else took his slot, and they took the idea a lot further than I wanted to take it. You know, it was just, I said, let's just think about it. And sometimes you fix those things. 9 months later, he came back and led in the thing that he was against. Because God changed him out. You know, I couldn't change him. But I tried to keep a door to this day. He's one of the dearest friends we have in the world. But sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't. But we're supposed to take it personal and try to do everything that we can. Sometimes we fix it. Sometimes we can't. There's no case that animosity should be built up, whether you are the offender or the offendee. Is that right? Is that the way you say that, offendee? I'm not sure that's a word, is it? If you're the one who caused the offense, or you're the one who offended again, or you understand what I mean, right? Either way, it doesn't really matter. No case is animosity supposed to be built up. It's supposed to be dealt with. That's the whole point that he's making. Things take priority over religious duty. How are we getting along on a personal level? That's it. Here's a second example. Agree with thine adversary quickly while you're on the way with him, lest at any time your adversary deliver you to the judge. And he says, you know, if he's about to take you to court, stop and try to do something about it quickly as you can. Don't let it get out of hand, because, you know, you don't get out till you pay the last penny. Ain't that what the rest of the verse says? He says it's going to cost you. Do everything you can and do it quickly. Do not let it go. The thing at stake here is a matter of reconciliation with your brother. Don't put it off. What does Ephesians tell us? Do not let the sun go down on your anger. Why? Because it only gets worse. If it's there, do everything you can today, because it festers and it gets worse. It's just like a thorn. If you leave it in there, if you don't go ahead and get it out, what's going to happen? The whole hand's going to be sore. You can't use the whole hand. It'll start festering and festering. You got to get it out sometime. That's exactly the whole point. It's quite possible that there's an illusion here that he's talking about, that God is the judge and we're going to have to stand before him sooner or later. So deal with this thing while you can. One day we will. The point, rather, is it does apply to us. The whole movement of the law, the thing towards which the law is pointing, is not simply the act of killing or assassinating, because they say, we haven't killed anybody. Jesus said, but you hate all these people, so you're just as guilty. You're at the first step. You need to deal with that, because that's where it can go. Simply the act of killing or assassinating but rather of hatred, of personal animosity. Why do we think all these rights belong to us? You know, did Jesus give up a lot of his personal rights? And we're talking about on a personal level here. We're going to get to the whole corporate thing here in just a minute quickly. He says the law does convict all men, and it's not meant to be fenced off to refer only to the extreme or the murder. He's talking to all of us. You know, I don't personally know anyone who has murdered someone. I remember the first shock I had of this was we used to go to a seminary from 3 hours away, so we had to get up and leave at 5 o'clock in the morning and make it by class by 8. And one morning we were about to walk out the door, and I had a knock on the door, and I'm thinking, who is at our house at 5 o'clock in the morning? And it was one of our church members who happened to be the magistrate. He said, I just wanted you to know such and such and so that you baptized 3 weeks ago. We just arrested him on a conspiracy to commit murder. I said, oh, well, that's great for today. They dealt with him. I visited him with him. They had him on tape. A guy was wired that he was trying to hire to kill his mother-in-law. He had never admitted it. Never once did he admit it. Oh, no, no. He said, oh, that guy, can listen to this one now. Oh, this guy just came up to me and said that he would kill somebody for this amount of money. Just out of the blue? Come on now. Didn't know him. Crazy. You know, I don't know anyone, and we can't say, well, you know, that's not me. But if you have a real hate for somebody and an anger that you don't deal with, it could lead to that. That's the issue that he's talking about on a personal level. There's no place for retaliation when personally abused. Leela Kuth said that her brother, she was talking to her, a friend one time, and said that her brother, when he was young, had a real problem with anger. And said her mom and dad did everything they could to help him, and nothing seemed to work. He just always kind of flew off the handle. So they found out something finally that worked. Every time he started getting angry, they bought him a shovel and sent him outside and said, you go dig holes in the backyard until you calm down. So the friend said, well, did it help? He said, well, you know, I think it did. It helped him get through some stuff. He said, well, what does he do today? He says, he installs in-ground pools. That's what he does. Did it affect him? Yeah. There's a way. There's a lot of people that have anger. All of us know someone who has uncontrollable anger. That's exactly what he's talking about. If you don't deal with it in the right circumstances, you'll kill somebody. That's exactly what Jesus says. You're just as guilty because that's where to go. You have heard that it had been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Boy, this is one of them, isn't it? It's found in Exodus, Deuteronomy, and Leviticus. Here's the deal. This instruction was restrictive, not prescriptive. You understand the difference? It was given to restrict a hard punishment, not to give somebody the right to do a hard. Well, eye for eye. That means if he did it to me, but if this is the issue, okay, quickly. It indicated the limits to which punishment should go. It did not necessitate that punishment was to be enforced. The reason is simple. It was a good way of eliminating possible blood feuds. Why? Somebody cuts off your brother's right hand, so I go and knock his head off. I don't just cut off his hand, I kill him. Because, oh, you know, whatever's been stolen for us, we don't want that back. We want that plus 10 million. Isn't it right? Isn't that the way it works? I mean, come on. Isn't that the way a lot of the law works now? You don't just get basically what was stolen from you. You want that plus the mental problem that you had to go through with it is worth 50 million. It's basically the same thing he's talking about. If someone cuts off your brother's hand, you don't have the right to go and kill him for it. That's the whole thing. Then there's warfare, right? So nothing is settled. It might limit the punishment that the guy who knocked off your brother's right hand gets his right hand knocked off. It's over with, and nothing else comes from it. There's no warfare. There's no family feud from it. It's restrictive. It's not prescriptive. But what are we here? Oh, eye for an eye means he does this to me, I can double that or triple that or whatever, because that's what, no, it doesn't say that. He's trying to curtail it. And you've heard, and, you know, there's actually, you'll see it, that is the problem with legalism. Because nowhere in the Old Testament or nowhere in the New Testament you start to see some of this come about. Here's what happens in legalism. Here's how it develops, okay? It became prescriptive and often exercised in the nastiest way. Here's an example of it, all right? In Matthew 5:39, I tell you, do not resist an evil person. What does this mean? Tolstoy was one of them, but even today, oh, that means that we shouldn't have any army, that we shouldn't have any guns ourselves. If somebody just comes and attacks us, you know, we just let it go. We don't do anything about it. That's not what it means. Here's what happens. When you take a verse and you take it out of the context, you end up having what we call a pretext. So you just kind of make it say whatever you want to say. It's called a PhD dissertation. Because they take one verse and they write 250 pages on that one verse. You have to study everything you study in the context. And you can't just take this one verse and say, this is where the whole thing comes from. You got to look over the whole Bible and see everything that deals with that. And see, that's exactly where you get in trouble. When people get in trouble, they don't do that because it takes a lot of hard work. It's a difficult question, but you cannot find the answer to this one right here alone in Matthew. You got to look all over the place. Matter of fact, what does Romans 13 say? What did Paul say? Oh, God's created the government with a gun for the purpose of helping deal with this kind of stuff. We're not exercising that right this moment very well. And we wonder why we have catastrophe going on. You know, sometimes they're evil governments, but it says, and that's exactly what Paul says in Romans 13, isn't it? Go back and read it. That's exactly what it is. He said it there for a reason. For these corporate things that they have to take care of that. We shouldn't have to take care of that on our own. But that's not the way it is. For he is a minister of God to thee for good, but if thou do that which is evil, be afraid. For he beareth not the sword in vain. Wow. For some of these people say, well, we should never have any. That's what they're trying to do now, defund the police. Then what you going to have? You're going to have cities where nobody wants to live? You're going to have states where nobody wants to live? I don't want to live in some of them already. Right? Who wants to live up there where there is no control? And that's not what he's talking about here, that we never have a position where we have to defend something. That's not the issue. It is a shame even to speak of those things which are done. Somebody has to defend it. I won't read these for the sake of the 2 Kings, where he's talking about his sword. What? Manasseh had shed all that innocent blood, and God held him accountable for it. He doesn't mean that we never stand up and do the right thing, especially from a corporate level. No. What does Proverbs say? All these things that God hates, and he lists them out. You have to look at the whole picture of all these things. You can't just take one little place and say, well, this is what this says. Okay, what does it say that in the rest of the Bible? You know, it's called cross-reference. Look and see. You said, well, there's 500 scriptures. Right. You got to go to all those and look at it before you develop a whole idea of how you're going to handle something. Right? Nowhere in the New Testament or the Old Testament does John the Baptist or Jesus or any of the apostles ever tell the soldiers to quit. Does he? He just says, be satisfied with your wages. Why? Because they understood that God was behind the whole deal with some government thing and some soldiers that had to be there. So don't get sidetracked by this thing because some people try to say, oh, yeah, that means we never do anything. If the evil people come, we just submit to them. No, he's talking about on a personal level, that we're not offended on a personal level. It's not talking about whenever somebody comes and tries to wipe out the whole place. That's not what it is. There are difficulties with this in understanding that in a sweeping sense, yet it's time not to be ministered. What is he after? He's talking about on a personal level in this whole context of all this thing from verse 21 through verse 48. It's a regular stunt that we see all the time in biblical exegesis. Quickly, this is all about personal insult and personal imposition. And Jesus gives us four examples. What does that mean? It means that we don't wear our feelings on our shoulder. You know, if I got mad every time somebody criticized me, I'd stay mad. Why? Because somebody's always criticizing. You know, the only reason they don't criticize, well, they'll either criticize you for not doing anything or what you do. They're always going to be there. It's just going to be part of it. Insult, that I don't take everything personal, so I get mad and angry, and it causes me to want to kill somebody. You know, sometimes you just want to be scriptural and lay hands on somebody, don't you? Right there. Come on, all of us feel that way sometimes, don't we? Oh, you can't tell me you have never been that upset with somebody. All of us have. That's not what it's about. But I say to you that if you resist, you resist not evil, but whoever shall smite you. Remember now, personal. He's not saying the nation just supposed to fold, and whenever evil comes and takes over, that's why God gave us a government, Romans, several places in the New Testament. What is he talking about? I think he's talking about, you know, if somebody would hit you in the face, would that be an ultimate insult? Would it? Absolutely. He says if they do that, just kind of push it off. Go ahead and turn the other cheek and let them do it again. Don't let it bother you. Don't take it so personal. Just get on with it. Insult. I read some hilarious insults. Groucho Marx, this is when he said, you know, I have had a perfectly wonderful evening, but this wasn't it. He's talking to his date. Is that right? Here's a conversation between George Bernard Shaw and Winston Churchill. George Bernard Shaw sent this letter to Winston Churchill, and this is what he said. He said, I'm enclosing two tickets to the first night of my brand new play. Bring a friend if you have one. Is that an insult? Yeah. Here's Winston's response to that. Cannot possibly attend the first night. Will attend the second one if there is one. Personal insult. That's the whole thing Jesus is talking about. He's not talking about on a corporate level. He's talking about not talking about on a government level. He's talking about when people offend you and they insult you, how do you respond? He says if they hit you on the cheek, if they insult you one way, turn the other one. Then they don't know what to do. It kind of dissolves the whole issue. And if a man will sue you at the law and take away your coat, let him have your cloak also. I wonder, is he talking about, you know, the Roman soldiers had the right, if you're just a civilian, you're walking along, they could just come and take you and make you carry something for them. And you couldn't do anything about it. Could be that. If a soldier comes and says, you carry this for me 1 mile, he says, don't get upset, carry it 2 instead. What do they do with that? They don't know what to do with that. That's how we handle that. We don't take it personal. You might not like it. You just say, you know, God's got all this in control. Just let it go. Just let it go. You know, I've known a few people in my life that they don't know how to let it go. They're bulldogs. And it's an indictment against their spirituality. Why? Because they always cause a lot of trouble over the smallest little issue that doesn't mean anything, and they just won't let it go. So what do? You just avoid those people. You know, unless you have to, you just stay away from them. Why? Because you understand until God changes them, you don't have time for that. Isn't that right? That's exactly what that is. If someone sues you for it, not only give him what he asked for, but did I read the whole thing? And if a man will sue you at the law and take away your coat. He's talking about probably the tunic. The tunic was the one that went close to you, and especially, actually, part of the law says if you take that from him, you have to give it back to him overnight so he won't freeze to death, even if you get it back tomorrow. Okay, so it was something really, really close and important to you. And he says, well, if they see you for that, just give them the rest of it. Don't get caught up in it. Does that mean you never go to court with somebody? Doesn't mean that, exactly. You know, sometimes you have to, but just on a personal level, are you doing it just because you're offended so much personally? That's the issue in all of this. It is personal. And whoever shall compel you to go a mile, go with him too. That's actually the Roman thing I was talking about, because they could pull you out and say, you know, carry this a mile. Just do it, go too with him. Don't take it personal. You know, it's hard not to wear your feelings on your shoulder, isn't it? Hello? I understand personalities have a big deal with that. But what are the gifts of the Spirit? They're supposed to be maturing in us to help us handle all that. You just don't worry about it. You know, just go on to the next thing. That's what he says. Give to him that asks you, and for him that would borrow of you, don't turn away. You know, there's some people you don't want them to know you own this particular item. Am I right or wrong? Daddy always told me, Daddy was a logger half of my life, and it was just a given. You never ask to borrow someone's chainsaw. That was just a no-no. Not only was it a main tool, but they were so easy to be broken and they cost a lot to fix. All right? So do you have one of those pieces of equipment? Ladies, maybe you have something. I don't know what it'd be, a sewing machine or I don't know. Did you just rather some people that you know, you don't want them to know you have it? Because you don't want to let them borrow it because you know what's going to happen to it. Right? Is that personal? Oh, yeah. That's what he's talking about. You know, if you got it and they could actually need it, or, you know, don't throw this idea out. If you know they need a chainsaw, go buy them a cheap chainsaw. You can buy a cheap chainsaw. It's not going to last them anyway. Just go buy them a cheap chainsaw. He said, you need one of these, and don't let them borrow your $400 one. Just go buy them one for $100 and be done with it, right? There's all kind of ways you can do the right thing. But don't take it so personal, you know, right? The New Testament makes it clear that the Christian has given over his rights to the Lord Jesus. I want to read this by Amy Carmichael. Here's what she said. Where did I put it? In the book Gold by Moonlight. She said, a crucified life cannot be self-assertive. Wow. Is that personal? It cannot protect itself. It cannot be startled into resentful words. The cup that is full of sweet water cannot spill bitter-tasting drops, however sharply it is knocked. Never let the words and the worries of others become the focus of your life. That's about as personal as you can get. That's what Jesus is talking about. What is it we get so hung up about that's really just a personal deal? And it's not going to matter in eternity anyway. Does Jesus deal with our personal life? You better believe it. And if you and I think that we can separate church from how we treat people, we've missed it 1,000 times. Jesus cares about our personal, how we deal with people. Let's pray. Lord, just forgive us. We get so caught up in ourselves. We get so caught up in a society that tells us that we are number one, that we should focus only on ourselves. And therefore, oftentimes, we neglect the most important things in our life for ourselves because the world tells us that's what's important. Lord, remind us that you take so personal how we deal with issues. It's not just an external game. Lord, remind us to analyze what is important to us, what can we just let go off and not have to deal with and just let you take care of it, and what we should focus on, that you'll be glorified and that people will want to know you because of it. In Jesus' name, amen.